Hey, this is Peter Biello, host of the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. It's really important to have a news roundup like this every week because the news moves so quickly. We need time to process it, and the roundup helps us do that. If you use and enjoy this podcast, please support it in an amount that's right for you. Make a gift of $10 or $20. Give now at nhpr.org or just follow the link for the show notes. All right, here's the roundup.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from UR subscribers and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. The State Liquor Commission and the State Employees Union exchange words publicly over whether state liquor store employees are put at risk by large, possibly illegal all-cash transactions. Residents in the Lakes region look at the future of the Laconia State School, and a bear in the Upper Valley that caused trouble for residential neighborhoods is back to her old habits, and the Fish and Game Department is struggling with what to do about it. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them this hour. You can call into the exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And we are streaming a live video of this radio show today, so tune into NHPR Exchange on Facebook and take a gander. We'll all be here entertaining you, spelling out the week's news, answering your questions, and just looking fabulous like these gentlemen here at the table today. Joining me here today is Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Josh Rogers, NHPR's Josh Rogers, and Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader. Thank you, everybody, for being here.
Thank you, Peter.
So joining us later in the show will be NHPR's Annie Ropeek. She'll be talking about the Laconia State School. Also, Representative Annie Custer will join us for a discussion of the VA Mission Act, which was signed into law this week, and it extends the VA's ability to provide private sector health care to qualifying veterans. She was a co-sponsor of the legislation. If you've got questions about those or other stories in the week's news, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number for you to call, 1-800-892-6477. So, big story this week is the dispute between the state's largest employees union, the State Employees Association, and the State Liquor Commission. The SEA is calling for new leadership at the State Liquor Commission, and at issue is how the Liquor Commission handles large cash transactions. Josh, you've been covering this story. What are liquor stores allegedly doing, or what have they allegedly done with these cash sales to cause this dispute?
Well, IRS regulations require people buying more than $10,000 worth of liquor in cash to fill out forms disclosing such purposes. For years, it's been a question of how rigorously the Liquor Commission is informing customers of the need to do that, whether they've been facilitating skirting that requirement by dividing up sales. That's alleged to have happened when SEA President Rich Gulla and Executive Counselor Andy Valinsky visited a liquor store in Keene in February. They say they witnessed a transaction of $24,000 that was divvied up to remain under the $10,000 threshold. And when that was reported to the Attorney General's office, the Liquor Commission fired the employee involved. There have been criticism from the Liquor Commission of Gulla and Valinsky for the way they handled what some people are considering a sting operation. This is, as Kevin has reported, a topic that's been under discussion for some time. The position of the Liquor Commission is that we require employees to follow the law, and you know, the Attorney General is reviewing these bulk sales, but there's also been ample documentation that big cash sales have been taking place, particularly of Hennessy cognac.
Well, let me ask you, Kevin, because at issue here is the question of whether or not liquor store employees are being put at risk, and sort of both sides have accused the other of putting them at risk. But what's the argument there? How are they at risk?
Yeah, essentially, there certainly seems this week to have developed a division in the ranks among employees at some of the liquor stores. Obviously, we had a liquor store employee, a whistleblower, who assisted both Rich Guller and Councilor Walensky at the Keene store in terms of being able to witness that transaction. That employee was summarily fired. That person is now appealing their firing and has the support of the union as well as Councilor Walensky in going through that appeal. But there are employees now starting a petition who work at some of these liquor commission outlets, essentially saying that this puts them more at risk because the public is now watching how they are conducting themselves and raising questions about how they're working. We've seen this for a number of years in the Liquor Commission, which is to say, and it sort of makes some sense, the union is pretty strong throughout all these liquor outlets. But at the same time, as Josh knows, and we've reported before, a lot of these employees are essentially political appointees. They're people, many of them, who've been connected somehow to a politician, to a state official. So many of them don't have as much allegiance to the union as they have allegiance to their sponsor or to the management at a liquor commission that helps keep them there. So there's often been this tension in these stores between employees who side with management and employees who are so solidly with the union.
And it is also worth pointing out that Rich Guller, the president of the SEA, before he assumed that role, was an employee of the Liquor Commission who had been at odds with the Liquor Commission through the years.
Okay, good to know. Dean?
Yeah, and as Josh noted, you do have this curious circumstance of these bulk purchases of Hennessy, particularly in the southern tier of the state, so along the border. We've now seen a fair bit of reporting on it. And as Kevin mentioned, the union leaders had some reporting suggesting that the employees do feel kind of caught in between their union and the Liquor Commission. They don't like the idea that surveillance footage is being shown, that people are starting to understand kind of exactly how the process works in ways that they think potentially puts them at risk. You know, so far we're waiting for this AG report, and so far Governor Sununu said he has confidence in Joseph Malika, the chairman of the commission. But these kinds of commissions can be very political. So we've been talking about this story now for several months, and it does not seem to be going away. So clearly, I think we haven't seen the last of how it's going to play out.
Yeah, well, part of the story this week had to do with the State Employees Association ad that they are running as part of this campaign. Let's hear a bit of it.
The New Hampshire Liquor Commission is a $1 billion operation, and it deserves a professional management team capable of overseeing that, and one that puts employee safety at the forefront of its operational planning.
So this ad, well, Josh, is this?
It's a campaign style ad. It is on the SEA website. It's not like they're putting this out in the world their own website. But I will say the tone from the union and also from the Liquor Commission in response. And I'd be curious to know what Kevin thinks, because I certainly can't recall reading comments from a state entity talking about its workers in the way that, or at least the union, in the way that the Liquor Commission leadership, in a statement in response to this video, they said this is the latest in the, quote, well-orchestrated charade of the SEA president. You know, this is from deeper in the statement. By its words and actions, the SEA leadership continues to drive an agenda that is unproductive and potentially damaging to the brand, our employees, and the state of New Hampshire.
Kevin, yeah, is this...
It's very strongly worded, and you're right, Josh. It's you don't often see that. I think it seemed like this week Governor Chris Sununu was trying to in any way he can really try to dampen this controversy and say let's take a time out. Let's
wait for the Attorney General.
Exactly. Let's wait for this report. It's going to come out eventually. But he's four square behind Malika, the chairman, as Dean pointed out, which at the end of the day, it's the governor who matters. If as long as Malika has the support of this governor, he's got a fixed term and he's not going anywhere.
And I will just say on the campaign ad, it is a campaign style ad. We had the ominous music at the beginning of it. It's a tried and true technique to put an ad up on a website. have people pick it up. It goes viral. We're talking about it here. I'm sure other media outlets will talk about it as well. So, you know, for a fairly small investment, you can kind of get your point across to a much larger audience without actually having to pay to run the ad on television. And so I think that's probably their intention with it.
We get an email from Diana regarding the Liquor Commission. She writes, "It would be good to know how many employees the union polled to see whether the sting operation should go forward and whether they supported calling for a new CEO. Diana writes, "Last I knew, those employees did not want new leadership there, but now might for the union's leadership." So no sense yet. Kevin, you mentioned that they were doing some polling, but we don't know how many people.
We don't know. And also, I think it's worth mentioning in this context that the internal politics of the State Employees Association can be very fractious, very factional, and it's often hard to know, you know, who's doing what. And so it's hard as an outsider to necessarily read every tea leaf in terms of inside the SEA.
So what signs should we be looking for in the coming weeks for movement on this?
Well, I just think we'll wait for the AG's report and see what happens with the whistleblower complaint.
Okay. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're speaking with our guests today about the week's news and still to come, what to do with the Laconia State School. It's a valuable piece of property, and there are several options on the table. Do you live in the area? What do you think should be done with it? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Another story in the news this week is that the New Hampshire Attorney General's office revealed Tuesday that a grand jury had been convened to look into allegations related to a comment State Senator Andy Sanborn allegedly made to a State House intern in 2013. Worth mentioning that the grand jury found no criminal wrongdoing. But Kevin, what were those allegations?
Well, essentially, the initial allegation against Senator Sanborn was that he made some comments to an intern that were sexually inappropriate, that were heard by a number of folks, and internally at that time, this was back in 2013, an in-house kind of investigation was done that interviewed the intern and a number of other people. They were satisfied this had been dealt with properly, and even the Attorney General's office essentially indicated they looked at what internally had been done and said that's okay. Subsequent to all that, it was disclosed somewhat recently, last fall, that in addition to that contact, a short time after this exchange, this inappropriate comment, Sanborn had called it a crass joke. This particular intern was paid some cash by the Senate Chief of Staff, who indicated to him that this was intended to be money given to the intern before he got his first paycheck as a part-time position that he transitioned to in the Senate Clerk's office. So we didn't know this, but once it became known to the Senate President, Chuck Morse, that cash had changed hands somehow, at least for a brief period of time, The intern returned that money. He told investigators the next day. But late last fall, once this became known, Senator Morse asked the Attorney General to do an investigation and look into this. And this is one of the differences between this Attorney General and a lot of Attorney Generals in the past. And I don't know if Josh feels the same way, which is a lot of these investigations about public integrity that don't amount to anything often never in the past have never been reported. I mean, folks looked into it. Even things have been brought to a grand jury in the past. No charges were brought. The thing gets dropped and oftentimes is never disclosed by state prosecutors because it's much what happens you see in federal prosecution. If there are no charges, if there is no case, there is no story. But this attorney general is very much a supporter of transparency. And in the media, we love this. But this is who he is. This is how he's going to be. And it's going to make people uncomfortable at times. And this certainly has made State Senator Andy Sanborn pretty uncomfortable because even though the report says no criminal wrongdoing here, no charges, There's no credible evidence, as the report says, that the cash had any connection to the comment and the part-time job this guy got. It's still not helpful to him in the middle of a congressional campaign.
Certainly you read the report, and the report, it went to a grand jury, as Kevin said, and there were 18 witnesses audio taped. Apparently, Senator Sanborn was not one of them, which I thought was interesting, but 18 witnesses, and, you know, there were some evocative details of, you know, former Senate Chief of Staff Jay Flanders handing an envelope to this intern who went on to a part-time job in the clerk's office, and one thing in the report said that, you know, if this were seen as a, you know, essentially a quid pro quo, cash for silence, that he later applied for a full-time job in the clerk's office and was not given the job, now works as a lobbyist, and was not interested, as Kevin pointed out earlier this week in a column, was never really interested in pursuing this case publicly. Certainly there's talk around the State House about, you know, might this have been handled differently if this intern was a young woman rather than a young man. You know, Senator Sanborn has said that one of the statements he's made in his own defense is, yes, this was a crass comment, in as he put it, but this was made, he said, in the presence of his wife. You know, one can make of that what one will. You know, the political upshot of this for him as he's running for Congress, which we shouldn't forget, you know, is unclear. I mean, there's certainly he hasn't done a great deal of fundraising. Most of his money, his campaign, is his own. There's a sense that this candidacy is sort of failing to launch, potentially zero support from his Senate colleagues. But, you know, the voters aren't really paying attention yet. But as Kevin said, this isn't great news for him that we're talking about this crass comment.
Yeah, I think it's a mixed bag in the end. I think on the one hand, it keeps bringing the issue back up for him to have to deal with it should his opponents in the Republican primary in the first CD decide to make an issue of it. On the other hand, he can point to the report and say it's been looked into. I've apologized for it. Let's move on. So I do think it's a bit of a mixed bag for him going into that primary in September.
Really quickly before the break, let's talk about one more story that emerged this week. Josh, you were covering this one. The Governor's Council on Diversity and Inclusion issued a preliminary report this week recommending, among other things, that the state adopt the holiday Juneteenth, which marks the end of slavery. What did the report recommend?
Well, the report laid out the procedural steps the commission is going to continue to go through, and it's worth remembering that this commission, as well as a civil rights unit in the AG's office, was formed by Governor Sununu in the wake of racially charged incidents in the state, including the, you know, sort of alleged harassment of a biracial child in Claremont, where involving a noose that some people consider was really a hate crime. Others said no, but a tense issue there. And so the governor formed this commission and a civil rights unit in the Department of Justice. The commission is going to issue its full report next year. Juneteenth, that recommendation was one of the few ones you could pull out of the preliminary report that was very clear. There was talk of, you know, harmonizing current civil rights law to with respect to gender identities, and that's going to take place. And as we remember, when same-sex marriage went through, that's not an uncomplicated matter. There are many parts of the law that discuss that, and so that will take some kind of housekeeping to make sure those things harmonize. There's talk about outreach to their listening sessions and talk about reaching out to communities that might not be making it to the listening session. But so, you know, kind of stay tuned on that.
Okay. Well, this is the
week. New Hampshire is one of only five states, apparently, that does not formally recognize Juneteenth.
Yeah.
And the only one in the Northeast.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that change may be coming.
Could be.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We're speaking with NHPR's Josh Rogers, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and the union leader's Kevin Landrigan. And with you, we hope. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Coming up after the break, we'll speak about Mount Sunapee Resort and the fact that leases might change hands there. The state says it wants more oversight. What do you think about that? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, which is where you can also watch a live video of this broadcast. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and the author of the website NH Political Capital, Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, NHPR's Josh Rogers, and NHPR's Annie Rupeek, who in just a few minutes will be speaking to us about the Laconia State School. Hi, Annie. Welcome.
Howdy.
So before we get into this part of the program, I just want to let you know about the conversation we're scheduling for next week. It's part of our Race for the First series. Host Laura Kanoy is sitting down with candidates running in New Hampshire's 1st Congressional District. And on Monday, she'll be speaking with Maura Sullivan. What questions do you have for her? Send them now to exchange@nhpr.org. And remember, you can listen back to all the interviews in our Race for the First series at nhpr.org or subscribe to it. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. So let's get caught up on this on the Sunapee story, because Colorado-based Vail Resorts says it will acquire Mount Sunapee Resort, but the state says it needs more oversight than it has. Josh, you've been covering this, but before we get too deep in the weeds, help us understand what's being acquired here. It's not the actual mountain. It's not the property, but it's a lease, right?
Well, it's Mount Sunapee Resort.
It's the resort.
And the lease, and you know what's it in, and the Vail is announced that it's going to buy Triple Peaks LLC, which the company owns Mount Sunapee Resort. It owns the Okemo Mountain Resort in Vermont and Crested Butte in Colorado. In their statement, Vail said that the land lease transfers involved in New Hampshire and Vermont, Sunapee and Okemo, will require clearance from state regulators. But Attorney General Gordon McDonald has raised the issue that the way that the New Hampshire structured its original deal back in 1998, a leaseholder can't transfer or sell a lease without state approval, which had been the case in 2008 when the state when the first transaction involving CNL Lifestyle Properties took place. Throughout, there's been the Mueller family has managed the mountain. But when OCZIF Capital Management, a controversial hedge fund, took over in 2017, they structured the deal in such a way that it eluded state oversight. Specifically, the Sunapee lease agreement allows the state to intervene if the company holding the lease sells or transfers the lease, but there's no contemplation in that original agreement for the state to intervene if the company holding lease is bought by another company. And so we don't know how this deal is structured. Attorney General Gordon McDonald raised this issue when OCZIF acquired this in 2017, and he raised it again this week that ideally this provision would be revisited to ensure the state has a place at the table in terms of approving this lease. But we don't know. We know that Vail has said it expects the states of Vermont and New Hampshire to have say-so, but we don't know the particulars of the deal. Governor Sununu said he learned of the deal only about 15 minutes before it was announced. He got a call from Tim Mueller, who was the manager, and he told reporters that it's his understanding that the Muellers are retiring. He said Vail's highly reputable, could be a good partner, wants to know more, and Attorney General McDonald would like the lease provision revisited.
Mm-hmm. Dean?
It's true. Sunapee has certainly had its critics in the past, particularly over expansion and the potential for building of additional housing. Some people have criticized the owners for being, a little bit secretive, these deals sort of catching people off guard. The reality is skiing is essential for New Hampshire tourism. The industry is consolidating. People want greater amenities. I've been skiing at Sunapee for probably almost 25 years now, and it's been a steady improvement in amenities. They now run year-round. They have an adventure park in the summer, and you're seeing that around the state and country where these ski resorts need to basically become year-round entertainment destinations in order to stay financially viable. And Vail has said that they will pump about $35 million into Sunapee and I think a couple of other resorts. So, that's the issue, kind of balancing the concerns of conservationists and people who want to protect the natural beauty of the Lake Sunapee region, balancing that with the economic viability and pretty significant changes in the ski industry that we've seen. And I think Sunapee has been trying to keep pace with that. And my guess is Vail will given kind of the consolidation in industry, Vail will continue to move it in that direction, probably in a more predictable way than the hedge fund that Josh just mentioned.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of the citizens in the Upper Valley, though, that, as Dean alluded to, wanted to keep Mount Sunapee the way Mount Sunapee always was, just as a small traditional ski area and not much more than that, is concerned when they see a behemoth in the industry, like Vail Properties, yeah. Get involved here. There's a lot of property in adjoining mountains that, under the lease, can't be developed unless it's somehow privately acquired, and then it would require all kinds of other approvals, including by the state. And I think I'm sure that's going to be what residents up there have questions about. And fortunately, with this governor, I mean, a former longtime general manager of Waterville Valley Resorts before he became governor, he knows a lot about the industry. And Waterville, as we've seen, has become more and more of a year-round resort. And so he's dealt with the economic cycles of ski areas as well, the kind of boom and bust that can occur with that industry. So he'll get in the weeds on this subject, I'm sure, and probably report back to the council on it.
Listeners, give us a call. If you have questions about the week's news, the number is 1-800-892-6477. And let's turn now to another bit of property with some public interest, the Laconia State School. NHPR's Annie Ropeek's here. She's been reporting on that this week. Annie, this property could be redeveloped. There are a few options on the table. But folks who are unfamiliar with what this is, Annie, what is it?
Yeah, so this is about a 200-acre property in Laconia. It's very scenic, mountain and lake views. And until 2009, it was the Lakes Region Facility, which was a minimum security state prison. And before that, for most of the 20th century, it was, or the 21st century? I can't even remember. But the since 1903 until the 90s, it was the Laconia State School, which was a residential facility for people with developmental disabilities, initially just for children and then for adults up to, I think, age 45. It had a really long and sordid history, lots of documented cases of abuse and neglect and overcrowding. And now it's in really dilapidated condition. There's some serious environmental hazards at the site, a lot of asbestos and mold inside some of these old buildings that are still on the property, and a lot of green space as well. So it needs some work before it can be flipped, but it is, you know, prime land owned by the state, and they would like to see something done with it that benefits not just Laconia, but the state as a whole.
Yeah, the aerial photograph at nhpr.org shows that it's right near the water, right?
And, yep. Yeah, and you can just see Lake, is it Winnesquam?
Winnesquam,
yeah,
yes.
and then the mountains beyond that, and I mean, it's right in town, and it's a big site. You know, you could do a lot with it, and so they're trying to figure out what exactly people want to see and what's kind of feasible going forward.
Well, all along the lines of people wanting to do something with it, what are the options that the contractors put on the table?
Yeah, so they've gotten three. They did an economic study, and they talked to a bunch of people in town about kind of what Laconia needs, what its housing stock and its commercial stock and industrial stock looks like now. And they came up with three scenarios for what could be done with the property that might be, you know, practical and good. All of them include housing. One of them centers completely on housing. They found that housing was a big economic obstacle to growth in Laconia, that they don't have enough places for workers to live, and so they can't grow economically in that way. And the other two concepts also include some housing, but one of them has as its centerpiece a resort and events space, maybe a conference center of sorts. And the other one includes a sports complex, which interestingly was the one that sort of generated the most discussion and debate at the public hearing I was at this week.
Mm-hmm. We had a comment from a listener going by the name of Spellchecker67. They wrote on your story online, Annie, why not make it low-income housing and help some people? It would be a good space for families and kids. Is that an option?
It is just fascinating to hear the debate around this. So a lot of the housing options include workforce housing, affordable housing, as well as market rate and townhomes and, you know, maybe some luxury spaces. I mean, it totally runs the gamut. And it was really interesting to hear Laconia residents at this hearing I went to this week talk about what they see affordable housing and workforce housing as representing. You know, they understood the need for housing to kind of spur economic growth, but they wanted to attract more families. They wanted to attract, you know, young entrepreneurs, and they sort of saw workforce and affordable housing as not compatible with those goals. They wanted more market rate housing to house families. At the same time, there were plenty of people in the room who said, we need more affordable. I mean, it's just really interesting to hear the debate around this. I think it really sort of encapsulates different visions for Laconia's future, the Lakes Region's future, and a lot of the generational divides and class divides that you see in those. And it'll be really interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, over the years, I've lived in a number of communities that have gone through this reimagining usage for a particular part of the community, whether it's land or Main Street or schools or what have you. And you know, you get all kinds of really interesting and creative of ideas, but you also start to see, as you just laid out a moment ago, some of the real kind of socioeconomic divisions and different conceptions for, you know, which populations within the community would benefit the most from it, and how do you balance economic development with the needs of lower-income individuals. And so it's going to be interesting to watch sort of how this develops, whether it becomes contentious. But it's really, these kinds of exercises are kind of a great microcosm for understanding the competing dynamics within a community. What do you want to do? It is a lovely piece of property. What do you want to do with it? And like you said, there are lots of different ideas, some of which aren't really compatible, others which are.
Yeah, I mean, they ruled out industrial altogether. They said, okay, Look, when he doesn't need that, it's not close enough to the highway, wouldn't make sense. And they feel like maybe mixing some commercial space in there would be good, but not focusing on it necessarily. It doesn't need to be like a regional shopping center or something like that, because they have access to those already. So housing really rose to the top. But a lot of the residents, they did this cool exercise where they put green and red stickers to show if they liked or didn't like an idea on kind of the big poster boards. And almost all of the green stickers, the most green parts of the boards were the open space and land banking ideas. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of people at the meeting who said, why redevelop it at all? Why not just tear down the buildings and have this beautiful green open space, you know, that we can use and recreate on?
Yeah, Rick from Meredith wrote in to say, I am concerned that this latest assessment of use for the Laconia State School options appears to ignore by leaving out previously voiced calls for agricultural land protection. Additionally, it's leaning towards residential development that has the potential to benefit a few rather than the many. So the premise there is that it's ignoring the option of agricultural land protection. Is that true?
Well, yeah. I mean, someone at the meeting handed to a bunch of the state commission members a report on the quality of the soil on the land. I guess it used to be farmed when it was the state school. It was part of what the residents there did. And it's supposedly prime agricultural soil in parts. So there, I talked to a few people who would like to see, you know, a community garden or a sustainable ag center and an education center there. I mean, a lot of really creative ideas beyond just your standard mixed-use development. Someone also suggested a co-working space to attract younger workers. But I also want to mention, I found it really interesting that a lot of the older residents at the meeting said, we need open space and undeveloped space to attract young people. And a bunch of the young people at the meeting said, we would love a sports complex. You know, we would love more year-round recreational space. And it doesn't mean it can't include open space, but one resident said he thinks health and wellness will be a way to attract young people to Laconia, that making it sort of an outdoor working community would be a way to boost the economy. So lots to unpack, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it seems like in addition to the housing, the young people is something that the community really wants to invest some effort into.
Yeah, I think you're going to see some of the generational issues sort of come out at this site as it goes forward.
Okay. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. And still to come, we'll be speaking about the VA Mission Act with Representative Annie Custer, who was a co-sponsor of the legislation. It was signed by the president this week. Do you have questions about it? Now's the time to call 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. Let's talk about the latest twist in the opioid crisis this week. Kevin, the Union Leader reported that more New Hampshire children are being removed from their parents' care, living with their grandparents and other relatives, and being assessed by the state for abuse and neglect as a result of the state's opioid epidemic. That was the word from a study commissioned by New Futures and done by Carsey School of Public Policy. How bad is the problem, Kevin?
Well, it's certainly getting a lot worse in the last couple of years. And it's kind of axiomatic with this opioid crisis that we've had. We've talked about any number of impacts that occur as a result of all these overdoses and in many cases deaths from drug abuse, but this report is the first one really to quantify how significantly greater these cases of abuse and neglect that the state has been investigating are connected to substance abuse. And the report found that, for example, from 2013 to 2016. There was a 21% increase in the number of children that were investigated by the state for abuse, and that the percentage in which substance abuse was a risk factor in all those cases rose from 41% to 51%, more than half of the cases of abuse and neglect have a substance abuse component to them. It's getting greater and greater.
And state's advocate, child advocate Maura O'Neill weighed in. What did she have to say about this?
Yeah, she. One of the interesting parallels she made was to the AIDS crisis in the 1990s, is that in that these children are kind of the forgotten component of this crisis. We look at how do we interdict with these addicts? How do we get these folks treatment that they really need? How do we get them off the street, get them housing, get them services? And in many cases, these children become the almost unrecognizable or unnamed statistic, because in so many cases, as this report indicates, the child's removed from that couple and in many instances can't have much contact at all with their real parents. And that's obviously a very sad tragedy.
Yeah, two of the most frequent stories I've seen in the news on this topic have been this hidden cost of children. You know, very heartbreaking stories about a parent who's had an overdose in a car and the child's in the back seat. And then I've also read a lot of stories about the grandparents finding themselves in a position that they had not planned for, which is raising their grandchildren because their child is dealing with an opioid addiction. So this really is kind of a hidden cost of this, and it has to be part of whatever larger solutions the state moves forward with.
And one of the other interesting things about the report was that I found notable was it looked at where are these kids ending up, and in only one third of the cases, they're actually ending up with relatives of the parents. So in two out of every three cases, these kids are essentially getting put in places where they had no previous contact before, and placed with people who may be providing the greatest of care, but don't have any connection at all to their real parents, and can't help these children deal with the trauma that has occurred as a result of their parents' abuse.
You're talking about temporary foster homes. Is that the idea?
Yeah, essentially, most of them are put in licensed foster care, or almost half of them are put in licensed foster care, and there are also group homes. About one in every five are put in large children's group homes.
We've already talked about that system being heavily taxed. Is it taxed? Yes. in terms of the kind of the usage and overextension of people's ability to provide care for the kids.
And New Futures, the group that commissioned the study, they were calling for policymakers to fund programs that support and strengthen families, to adopt prevention strategies. Did they ask for anything in particular in the wake of the study?
One of the things we saw during this legislature was a real push for early intervention funding for a lot of these private nonprofit providers for DCYF that assist in DCYF and trying to get more money out the door to these programs to help basically serve kids and families at the beginning of the crisis, not after the crisis is full-blown.
Well, listeners, just as a reminder, you can find the stories that we're discussing today linked at our website, nhpr.org, and the conversation continues after the break. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. We were speaking earlier with NHPR's Josh Rogers and Annie Ropeek. Thanks to them for joining the conversation. Still in the studio is Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences, and Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader. Answering your questions, if you have them, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll talk about the VA Mission Act and those pesky bears in the Upper Valley after the break. Stay with us.
Did you know a tiny piece of moon rock is embedded in stained glass at the Washington National Cathedral? Or that you can visit a 400-year-old bonsai tree at the National Arboretum? Washington, D.C. is brimming with incredible sights and historic monuments, and you and a friend could be on your way. Simply make a gift to NHPR today to support the news you trust and the programs you love, and you'll be automatically entered to win. But don't wait, we're giving away this trip on Saturday. Give now at nhpr.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and author of the website NH Political Capital, and also Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader. Give us a call to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. 6477. And we're going to talk now with Democratic Representative Annie Custer. She was a co-sponsor of the VA Mission Act, which was signed into law this week. And among other things, it streamlines the many systems under which eligible veterans will get care from private hospitals through the VA. Congressman Custer joins us now. Thank you very much for being here.
Delighted to be with you, Peter, and greetings to Dean and to Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Of course, glad to. So tell us about the VA Mission Act. What does it do to the CHOICE program? The CHOICE program was the previous iteration of a system that gave veterans private care through the VA.
Right. So just to take us back a couple of years, folks will remember the Phoenix, Arizona scandal where veterans were being kept for a long time on wait lists and didn't get access to care. So shortly after that came to everyone's knowledge, our committee, the Veterans Affairs Committee, held a series of a dozen hearings and introduced and passed through Congress quite quickly the CHOICE program. And what New Hampshire veterans will recall is that the idea of having access to community care and a choice between veterans administration care within the VA system and community care was a good idea, but the administration of it was very problematic. There was a third-party administrator. People were kept dangling, waiting for appointments. Some of the community care providers were not paid in a timely way. So this VA Mission Act is cleaning all of that up. It's a bipartisan effort. I was one of two Democratic co-sponsors in the House, and I attended the signing ceremony this week. It passed the House and the Senate. It was signed into law by the president. And the idea is to streamline access, to give veterans this choice between the VA and community care providers. And another very important provision is to give more robust caregiver support for post 9/11 veterans who have caregivers in the home.
So there was the VA Choice Act. There was line items in VA Medical Center budgets called community care, which was a separate pot of money for the same thing, essentially. Those would be combined. But are you saying that there will be no longer a third party administrator, which was in some ways responsible for some of the headaches of the Choice program?
Right. The idea is that veterans will be able to work directly with the VA. There was a last-minute compromise where at least with regard to TriWest, in the western part of the country, there will be some programs that are delivered via that third-party administrator. But what we're looking forward to in New Hampshire is a much more collaborative approach. I've been working with Al Montoya, who is the new administrator of the Manchester VA, and he had come down from White River Junction. They are working on direct relationships with these community care providers. So, for example, for ambulatory surgical care, for various clinics in the community, so that when a veteran gets that care in the community, they can just deal directly with them. The bill will be paid in a timely way. There will be a collaborative contractual relationship. And the other big, big breakthrough that is happening at the same time is finally getting the electronic health record such that the veteran can be tracked through the system coming out of the DOD into the VA for care in the veteran care. And then the goal would be that record could pass directly from community care providers back to the physicians at the VA. And that's something that's been problematic at this point.
I want to ask you about one of the main criticisms of the VA Mission Act, which is that some say it may starve VA facilities of funding in favor of sending veterans to private hospitals. In your view, will this bill harm existing VA facilities and services by diverting funds away from them?
Well, that's the crux of the political problem. I know that there are some Republicans that want to privatize the whole system, and if that's their goal to starve the VA, that's problematic. My goal is to find the right balance, and I'll be speaking today on the floor of the House to make sure that we have sufficient resources and funds to maintain a strong and vibrant VA while some veterans get their care in the community. And I think there is a balance to be found. Veterans often prefer care within the VA. They prefer to have providers. 40% of the healthcare providers in the VA are veterans, and they prefer to have providers that understand their individual situation. But what we know in New Hampshire is that if you live up in Coos County and you're 2 hours away from the nearest facility and it's winter and you have to go for weekly blood tests or mental health checks, you would prefer to have your care in a more accessible, convenient way. And we have great community providers that can have a contractual relationship with the VA. So it's all about finding that balance. We don't want it to be duplicative. We want to make sure that the core services are available to our veterans at the VA, but we want to, for convenience sake, either if they have to wait a long time or have a long distance to travel, that they could get the care in the community. And that's the balance that we're looking for. I've been meeting with previously Secretary Shulkin, and then just this week in New Hampshire, the acting Secretary Peter O'Rourke, to talk about finding that balance. And that's what we're looking for, a bipartisan solution where we can find that. But I'm aware of that criticism. I'm very aware of that criticism.
Okay. Last question for you, Congresswoman Custer, and that's that the Mission Act also allows the VA to assess where new facilities might be built. I know it's early in the process, but do you have any indication that there might be new facilities on the way for New Hampshire?
Yes, absolutely. We are talking about that. Again, I mentioned ambulatory surgical centers, and I've got legislation about making sure that type of facility is available. I've been talking with Mr. Montoya about that. We're waiting anxiously for the task force report. It's been several months now, and I've been saying, you know, let's have those solutions come forward and let's assess that. But we will definitely have some type of new facilities in New Hampshire. We already have a brand new CBOC up in Littleton, New Hampshire. That's the community outpatient care that's run by the VA that's been very successful. So I expect New Hampshire will see new resources, and that's what I'm speaking on later. Peter, I just want to say very quickly, because I didn't want to leave the wrong impression, the more robust caregiver support will extend beyond just the post-9/11 veterans. So all eras, if they're family caregivers, they will be compensated fairly. And I think that's a really important part of this bill as well.
Well, Congresswoman Annie Custer, thank you very much for taking some time to speak to us about it.
Well, thank you for giving me the time on your show. And I will be fighting for veterans every step of the way. And I very much appreciate your interest.
You have a great day. Thank you very much. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Really quickly, while we're still on the topic of veterans, Dean, you know, a year ago, Congress passed and the president signed the Whistleblower Protection Act. Now this June, we've got the Mission Act. Seems like veterans issues are the bipartisan issue that really can reach the president's desk reliably.
Well, yeah, veterans issues are always very important, both in terms of policy and in terms of electoral consequences for not following through. I thought that phone call really encapsulated the challenge that Congress is facing in striking a balance between improving facilities by pumping new money into them, particularly when there is this undercurrent among some conservatives for privatization, and doing a better job of integrating veteran care into the surrounding community and kind of striking that balance. The other obvious implication for Congresswoman Custer is, you know, one of her potential challengers in the second congressional district is Stuart Levinson, who is one of the original whistleblowers, and he's been very critical of Congresswoman Custer, saying she was kind of late to the game and not really involved until she was pushed to do so. So that's an interesting subplot that's going to play out until November.
Yeah, a couple other Republicans in this race, Steve Negrin, Lynn Blackenbecker, both recognized veterans who had some accomplishment in that field. So, but your question was very apt about show me the money, and meaning show me the money for the support of the existing system. Because, you know, just as Trump is signing the Missions Act, the Washington Post is reporting the Trump administration is working against legislation to actually fund it, because many in the Trump administration really support privatization and don't want a robust VA infrastructure system. So there is this tension that's going to continue to occur.
We'll have one more story to discuss here, and that is usually at this time of the week we talk about an animal story, and usually it's a funny, happy story, but it's not quite happy this week. It's actually quite serious. Bears are once again sort of a nuisance in the Upper Valley. Just this week in Cornish, police shot a bear that was killing chickens and not running off when confronted by humans. Didn't seem to be afraid of humans, which is not a good sign. Joining me now to talk about human-bear interaction is Andrew Timmons of New Hampshire Fish and Game. Andrew Timmons, thank you very much for being here on the Weekly News Roundup.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you've been monitoring some bear activity in the Hanover area. What's happening there?
Yeah, I do want to just reiterate, you know, we don't view bears as nuisances. We do know bears can get into conflicts with folks, but
right.
it's really about doing our part so that we can coexist with bears. But as far as what's going on in Hanover, probably many of the listeners recall kind of the long, drawn-out story regarding the Hanover sow. We ended up trapping and moving the yearlings last year, but the sow at that point in time had broke away from the group, and she actually kind of disappeared out of Hanover for most of the summer, so no action was taken. Well, she showed back up in Hanover late fall as expected, but really didn't cause any conflict. And then this April, she was spotted with four cubs of the year. And at the time, it was really too early to relocate that bear north because it was still very much winter time in the north. So we made the decision to put a radio collar on her. A GPS tracking collar is a better description. And because of that, we have the ability to know where she is at any point in the day. And we've been working conjunctively with Ben Killam on this project, but also, you know, the real person on the front lines is the assistant fire chief of Hanover, Michael Hensley. He's been really being an advocate for this bear. And so what we've learned to date is initially that bear was going after human-related foods, which is no surprise given her history, but Hanover's gotten very clean and there really aren't a lot of food there. Human foods there for her anymore. So now she's really converted to natural foods, but she is still kind of living in close proximity to folks to some degree. But we're trying to discourage her from being close to houses, move out deeper into the woods. And so far, we seem to be having some success with keeping her out of conflict. And much of that is due to the willingness of Hanover residents to clean up food attractants. So that's kind of where we're at the moment. We haven't made any final decisions on the ultimate outcome because we don't yet know the ultimate outcome. But if we can allow her to coexist without conflict, that's kind of that'd be the best option for everyone involved, including the bears.
And the incident that we reported on earlier this week about the Cornish police having to believing they had to shoot the bear that was coming really close to humans. I mean, how rare is that?
Well, the bear came in a yard and killed one free-ranging chicken. When bears get successful at finding food, they tend to be hesitant to leave. You got to remember, bears are persistent. When they find food, they're persistent. So I don't view what took place as being one of aggression. Rather, I view it as a bear just being persistent because it was excited. It found an easy meal. What that place needed was an electric fence, and that's what that place would have gotten the following that incident had the bear not been shot. So, you know, it's all about food attractants. We highly recommend that people utilize electric fence to protect their chickens. It's why we have a loan program where we loan out those materials. So we're just trying to teach people how to live with these animals.
Yes.
So that's really what took place there.
All right. Well, as we leave you, Andrew Timmons, seems like the big takeaway is secure your garbage, clean up after yourselves, don't leave food out that might attract bears.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. They're pretty easy to live with if we're willing to change our own behavior just a little bit so we can keep them out of conflict with us.
Little changes make a big difference. Okay. Well, Andrew Timmons of New Hampshire Fish and Game, thank you very much for joining us.
I appreciate the time. Thank you.
All right. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. And before we wrap up, I want to let you know about this fun thing we're doing at nhpr.org. We've got a bracket going for a little contest we have here to identify what captures the spirit of New Hampshire. There are a few options, but some of them include, you know, our first in the nation primary, the fact that we have 400 state representatives, loads of vanity plates here in New Hampshire. We got an interesting state motto, live free or die. Robert Frost, New Hampshire has the connection, though Vermonters may dispute the Robert Frost connection. Kevin Landrigan, Dean Spiliotis, any suggestions on peak New Hampshire?
Well, I took a quick look at the brackets, and in theory, we could end up with a final between Live Free or Die and the Old Man of the Mountain, and I think that would be a titanic struggle between two essential aspects of New Hampshire history and culture. But it's a lot of fun. People should check it out. But I think those are two that I think would potentially be hard to beat.
Yeah, okay. you would think in the past that taxes would be a leading contender, but I agree with Dean. I think the cultural icons will probably get more attention, and those will probably be the leaders.
The broader appeal, yeah. Of course. Are ties allowed? I don't know. Well, who's the judge on this? Well, Dean and Kevin, thank you very much for being on the show today and answering listeners' questions.
Thanks for having Peter. Us, Dean. Very much.
And that's it for today. Thanks to NHPR's Annie Ropeek and Josh Rogers, who joined us earlier in the show, as well as Andrew Timmons of New Hampshire Fish and Game and Democratic Representative Annie Custer. You can find links to all the stories we discussed today at nhpr.org, and the conversation continues on Facebook. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our intern is Abigail Sleeper, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.